Tahrir Square 5 years later, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In 2011, Egyptian protesters took to the streets and toppled a dictatorship. But where are the leaders of Egypt's January 25th revolution now?
So many of those people are now in prison or in exile. There have been a few releases over the last 2 years, but none of the leaders have been released.
Plus, Palestinian pop songs that glorify attacks on Israelis.
Maybe people outside our country, when they listen to these songs, they thought, this is people want to kill. But this is the only way to make it our land free.
And a Colombian band that loves to swing.
Swing for bossa nova, swing for bolero. And that's how we start like doing this kind of mix.
Sounds good to me. It's all today here on The World. It remains one of the biggest news stories of our time. 5 years ago, Egyptians went into the streets and called for the downfall of the regime. They surprised even themselves. What came to be known as the January 25th Revolution quickly ousted longtime dictator Hosni Mubarak. It was a pivotal moment in the wave of uprisings that became known as the Arab Spring. Today, on the fifth anniversary of the start of that historic revolt, the scene in Cairo's iconic Tahrir Square was very, very different.
Well, Tahrir Square at the moment is owned and controlled by the military and the police. So the only protesters who've been able to access the square today were a small group of pro-regime protesters.
That's Heba Morayev. She's with the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights in Cairo. Morayev says there's a bitter irony here.
The reality is that there's been a very strong intimidation campaign in the run-up to this day to prevent any protesters from coming out to commemorate the anniversary of the uprising.
What does the regime of General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi actually, how do they actually see this anniversary?
Despite the fact that there haven't been any significant plans on the part of protesters, whether secular or Islamist, to protest today, there was widespread raids of downtown apartments, of young activists, arrests, and a general mood of hysteria on the part of the regime, which for me reflects the fact that this is a day of deep trauma and anxiety for them.
Why wouldn't the regime want to highlight the kind of out with the old, in with the new chapter of Egyptian history? Because if they don't embrace that, don't they just risk getting painted as the same thing as Mubarak?
I don't think they're very worried about that. This is not a regime that has tried in any way to portray itself as progressive. This is a regime that oversaw mass killings in the summer of 2013, for which not a single police officer has been investigated. This really is a regime that has not felt the need to pretend to care about the rights and freedoms outlined in the Egyptian constitution, for example. And this is partly the case because in the aftermath of the overthrow of Morsi, the dominant discourse on the part of the Sisi regime has been one of restoring order and one that is deeply against everything that January 25th stood for. Calls for reform, calls for accountability of the police, calls for checks and balances on the executive. All of that is forgotten and is being very, very deliberately erased by the brute force of the security agencies.
Well, I was just wondering what the name of the elected president to Mohamed Morsi was. I couldn't even remember his name. So apparently they're succeeding in some ways. What about the leaders of that January 25th protest movement? Where are they?
You know, I've spoken to a few foreign journalists who've come to town to do anniversary pieces. Those of them who haven't really been following the news very closely keep asking me about, well, where's so-and-so? Where's so-and-so? And so many of those people are now in prison or in exile. There have been a few releases over the last 2 years, but none of the leaders have been released. So people like Ahmed Meher are still in prison, or Ahmed Doma, or Ala Abdel Fattah. These were incredibly popular voices, fearlessly criticizing the police and the security agencies, extremely active on social media, but also mobilizers on the street. So it is no coincidence that they have been kept behind bars and sadly are probably likely to remain so for the near future.
And what about Mohamed Morsi, also behind bars? What's happening with him?
So when it comes to the Muslim Brotherhood, the regime has continued on an overall policy of eradication. This is not the Mubarak era, because in the Mubarak era, what used to happen were cyclical arrests of the Brotherhood. So before an election, the leadership would be arrested, but they would be allowed to operate nonetheless. Whereas now the regime has been deliberately continuing with its campaign of arrests, sentencing multiple trials, multiple cases against Mohamed Morsi and other senior Brotherhood leaders, many death penalty sentences handed out, none of them implemented yet when it comes to the Brotherhood. But this general path of repression, with the general message being that they will never again be allowed to participate in politics. So we've seen no sign of any scaling down of that repression, or any sign that the kind of Mubarak era negotiated deal may be anywhere on the horizon.
That was Heba Morayef, a human rights activist in Cairo. Charlie Sennett from our partners, the Ground Truth Project, is also in Cairo. Sennett was a reporter there with our WGBH partners Frontline during the revolution 5 years ago. Great to have you on, Charlie. I want your view of what it's like to be back now, but give us the before shot first. Take us back to Cairo, to Tahrir Square 5 years ago.
5 years ago, Tahrir Square had erupted with mass demonstrations that called for an end to the regime of Hosni Mubarak, the dictator who had ruled for 30 years with a police state. And, you know, it was one of those scenes where you just couldn't believe it. I'd covered the region for 25 years, and here were people gathering, finally confronting the tyranny they'd lived under. And it really was a time of hope, a time of a feeling of a real new beginning. Very exciting. And frankly, I didn't think it was actually going to work, but it did. You know, they just kept to the streets. They kept protesting. They kept coming by the hundreds of thousands. They got up to 1 million protesters. And after 18 days of gathering in the square, Hosni Mubarak was forced to step down. And I think you could say Egypt was forever changed.
Yeah. So what's it now like to be back? Because we heard from Heba, very few protests, if any, today. Where's that hope?
That hope is really hard to find today. But I think, you know, Heba would be one of those people who could speak directly to the idea that it hasn't gone away. The way the regime cracked down in the last few weeks so hard on any possibility of protest, they really, really went after the opposition, or you might say perceived opposition, right? Anyone who's doing anything online that they see as somehow challenging the regime, or anyone who is, doing things like hosting a Facebook page or even cultural centers. Anyone with any inkling that's not in lockstep with the regime was cracked down. There were hundreds of arrests. The AP reported 5,000 homes were invaded. This is a regime that is showing that it's afraid that the people still want their rights. They still want democracy. And I think that fear was sort of palpable in the air today. There was a strange calm, particularly in Tahrir Square.
You actually went to Tahrir Square. What was it like today?
So here we were in Tahrir Square today, where the police are there, heavily armed police, armored police cars off to the sides. Very tense, little feeling there, a little nod of pro-police protesters, and police in black uniforms handing out candy to passersby in the traffic. I mean, it couldn't have been further from the scene we saw 5 years ago, where those same police were the target of angry protesters who wanted an end to the police state. You know, as Heba shared with you, it's a police state that has fully reasserted itself. The military is firmly in control. That was glaringly apparent on the streets of Tahrir Square today.
I doubt they're firmly in control because of candy. What was the point of that candy today?
Well, today is January 25th. So for years, this has been known as Police Day, a national holiday. And under Mubarak, it was intended, in his grand sort of autocratic gesture to say, hey, I want you to honor the police. But 5 years ago, the protesters saw a great opportunity to be very cynical about, quote, Police Day, and to call instead for mass demonstrations against the police, against the police state, and against Mubarak. So it was always called the January 25 revolution, that date being really sort of pregnant with irony, because it is Police Day. But back then, it was a challenge to that authority. Today, it was a clear reassertion of that authority.
Are you hearing from people in Cairo that they believe that the Sisi years are only a setback, that the revolution will be back on track?
Now I would say there is a sort of suspended sense of disbelief with El Sisi that he hasn't delivered on the promises to improve the economy. He has delivered on the promise to make it a more stable place, but it isn't a better place. And I think there's a real pressure on El Sisi right now to deliver on economic improvement. You know, he expanded the Suez Canal, hoping that that would bring in more money. That hasn't panned out. Unemployment is still very high. People are struggling. They're poor. And they're feeling the police state today. And I think it's like a clock ticking. You know, you can't continue to not deliver for the people and oppress them and not expect that yearning for democracy to come back to the streets.
Charlie, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
That was Charlie Sennett in Cairo today for our partners at the Ground Truth Project and Frontline. If you know the difference between QWERTY and AZERTY, then you are dating yourself. QWERTY and AZERTY, the two main types of typewriting keyboards for the Roman alphabet. The words refer to the first six letters from the left on the top row of your keyboard. A language like Spanish, for example, employs a QWERTY keyboard with modifications for certain accent marks. But in the last 20 years or so, computers have largely adapted the QWERTY keyboard and has become the standard in many parts of the globe. And then there's France. It's held on rigidly to the AZERTY keyboard, but now it seems the French government has had enough. The Ministry of Culture there has commissioned a study to try and find a layout which will make it easier to type correct French. Agnès Poirier is a journalist based in Paris. I mean, the experience of getting to France and typing on an AZERTY keyboard only to realize it's not a QWERTY keyboard. You've been writing gibberish. What keyboard do you use?
Well, I've got a surprise for you. Each time we French people go to America or Britain or some other parts of the world, what we find that it's not an AZERTY keyboard, and we think it's a scandal, you know.
Touché, as the French would say. Or maybe they don't say that.
So, and I've got another bigger surprise for you, actually. The AZERTY keyboard is here to stay. What's happening? It's the Ministry of Culture in France has decided that perhaps it was high time, and I'm very surprised it wasn't done before. After all, it's the country of Descartes, that there should be a standardized version of AZERTY. So that's all there is to the news, and I'm afraid to say next time you're coming to France, you'll have to get used to it.
Used to a new one, possibly. So I hear that Quebecers and French-speaking Swiss actually use the QWERTY keyboard, but with special accent marks. Why do you think they did not take to the AZERTY keyboard?
Well, they are traitors, obviously.
Of course.
They used to have the AZERTY keyboards, and I discovered with great dismay and horror that a lot of Francophone countries have adapted their own AZERTY into, you know, closer to QWERTY. But there are still some, you know, Francophone countries that are holding the fort and resist.
Could it be possible that the culture ministry runs a study on the AZERTY keyboard and then comes up with a keyboard that nobody's going to even understand?
Well, actually, there have been some attempts. You'll be surprised. One is called the BEPO keyboard.
BEPO
as in B-E-P-O, that is to say, you know, the first letters on the left side would start with those letters. And there's another one that was actually proposed in 1907 called the Z-H-J-A-Y keyboard. But none of them actually made through. So basically, the world is ruled by QWERTY and, to some extent, by AZERTY. And I think it's here to stay.
Agnès Poirier, based in Paris, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here's a memo from our Global Nation desk. Oscars so white, but also check out why Oscars so quietly not brown. So we did. It turns out, if you didn't notice, that not only are the Oscar nominations this year devoid of African Americans, there isn't a single Latino nominated either. But so far, not much pushback from Latinos in the industry. Felix Sanchez is a co-founder and chairman of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. Felix sees this as a classic case of Catch-22.
So on one hand, there's a concern because Latinos are not getting roles, period. I mean, that's where it starts. Mm. And then secondly, there are very few people who have standing and validity to kind of discuss what happens once you do get the role and you don't get the nomination.
A lot of people thought that Benicio del Toro from the movie Sicario would get nominated, but he wasn't. Are there any other Latino actors you can think of who were you considered a snub from the Oscars this year?
That was one film. I think that Oscar Isaac is certainly up and coming, but I don't think that the films necessarily were the type of films that would receive this kind of a nomination. So on that again gets us to the base problem that if you're not getting cast in these roles, you don't even have a chance of getting nominated.
Let me ask you this, because one thing that's sort of come out of the Oscars so white thing is whether to boycott the Oscars or not. And I get the sense that there's a real divide among African-American people in the industry. If we boycott it, then what could be the consequences? Are Latino actors and actresses thinking about the same thing?
You know, the award ceremony itself is the cosmetics part of the industry. It's the infrastructure that needs to be addressed. Again, there are very few Latino actors who actually can get invited to attend the event, and then to shun it is to kind of, you know, bite the hand that feeds you. Mm. And so there's this, we don't want to say to people, well, if you attend, you're a sellout. I mean, that is not the issue. I mean, the issue is engagement, but engagement from the studios, which need to cast more Latinos, and engagement from the talent agencies, which need to represent more Latino actors, writers, producers, directors. And that is where the problem occurs in the infrastructure of the business. And it's all at the very beginning of the process, not at the end of the process.
How is this discussed within the Latino community and the industry, Felix? Is there frustration? Is there anger?
There is so much frustration. And there's so much duplicity because, for example, the immediate reaction is we're going to do internships, we're going to do workshops, we're going to do showcases, and none of that gets you the role. And so it's all kind of there's just a lot of window dressing for the issue. It's institutional, the kind of just blocking out Latino actors and actresses from roles that they were never really considered for, and storylines that could include a more broader conversation of Latinos and who we are and our contribution in the United States as a whole. I mean, there's still this marginalization, not only for Latinos, but for Asians and Native Americans as well.
Felix Sanchez with the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. Thanks very much for your time, Felix.
My pleasure.
The current wave of violence in Israel and the West Bank has been going on for months now. There are almost daily Palestinian attacks on Israelis, mostly stabbings, but also car rammings and shootings. And Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire as they attack or attempt attacks. Palestinians say the violence reflects frustration after almost 50 years of Israeli occupation. Israel blames the violence on incitement on social media and on the songs Palestinians are singing in support of the violence. Tomorrow we'll hear about a different side of Palestinian art, but today Daniel Estrin brings us the latest CDs to hit the stores in the West Bank.
The guy behind the counter at DVD store in Ramallah unwraps an album he's selling, pops it into his computer, and plays the most popular tune, Ushak Itain, The Lovers of Stabbing.
He says, with your knife, the knife that you put in a soldier, you created panic bigger than an earthquake.
It's the record seller's favorite. His name is Mohammed Karasbe. He's 17 years old. That's the age of many Palestinians who have grabbed knives, stabbed Israelis, and gotten killed.
It makes me feel very bad for the martyrs. When I listen to these songs, I feel I'm in their place. I start feeling for their family.
He's selling 5 or 10 of these CDs a day for the equivalent of $1.25 apiece. When the stabbings were at their peak a few months ago, albums were released with tunes like Stab Stab and Jerusalem is Burning. Now he says new compilations are coming out. A few blocks away, a shop called Ramallah Records stocks a new CD, Martyr's Wedding Party. A guy named Fadi mans the store. He played a tune for me.
This is called Chaluha, like fire it.
Burn it.
Yes.
Put it on fire.
You see this CD? We cannot put the name of the company that made this CD because it will make for him a problem.
With the Israelis, you mean?
Yes, if the checkpoint
Do you know the company that made it?
Yes.
But you won't tell me?
No. Maybe people outside our country, when they listen to these songs, they thought, these people want to kill only. But this is the only way to make it our lands free.
You think that the violence will lead to a solution?
It will not create a solution. It will be a tool of pressure. For me to be a partner in creating a solution, I have to be strong. And unfortunately, the only strength I have is when I act in a violent way. People pay attention to me.
One guy young Palestinians are paying attention to is 30-year-old Qasim An-Najjar. He recorded this song, Behimmish, or It Doesn't Matter. The gist of it is, it doesn't matter what Israel does to Palestinians, they will continue to resist. But Najjar insists his songs do not encourage violence.
I don't have one song which talks about stabbing. I'm against stabbing. But I can understand all the means that the Palestinians use in resisting the occupation.
Are you ever sick of singing these kinds of songs and writing these kinds of songs? Don't you? Do you sometimes wish you could, you know, just write a song about love?
Of course I'm fed up, because I'd like to sing for my beloved, to sing a romantic song. But the presence of the Israeli occupation puts a big mission and a big duty on my shoulders.
He says his songs about the Palestinian uprising are big hits at weddings. Similar songs sometimes play at full volume from cars in the streets of Ramallah. But Mohammed from the DVD store in Ramallah says he recently stopped blaring the tunes from his shop at the request of other people at the mall where he works. He says they told him the songs provoke and get Palestinians nowhere. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Ramallah.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Frigid weather cripples a capital city. I'm not talking about Washington, D.C., though. I mean Taipei, the capital of Taiwan, a city where homes are not equipped for the cold, as this reporter can tell you.
I'm actually wearing a down jacket and several layers inside as I speak to you, and two pairs of socks, and I'm still cold.
That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Frigid temps, lots of snow, and a big dig out. People also lost their lives in this storm. It's been a rough few days here on the East Coast. But as bad as this latest storm has been, remember that we get hammered with cold weather each winter. So at least we're used to seeing our breath when we walk outside this time of year. Not so for residents of Taipei, the capital of Taiwan. They're in the midst of a once-in-a-generation winter. That's a word from Cindy Su. She's my colleague at the BBC in Taipei. And she is cold.
Not only am I wearing a coat and boots outside, I'm actually wearing a down jacket and several layers inside as I speak to you, and two pairs of socks, and I'm still cold.
Inside, you say? I mean, no heat?
Indoors.
No heat in your office or your house?
My home, and actually most offices and homes in Taiwan do not have indoor heating, because generally the island doesn't see this kind of cold weather. So that's the problem we have when it gets really cold here. It's actually in many ways colder than probably in Boston or the UK, London or New York, because indoors you have no reprieve. You know, I mean, in cold weather places you can always go inside and get warm. But in Taiwan, there's no place to hide.
Wow, that sounds really rough.
Most homes do not have indoor heating. Some people get by with space heaters, but they don't actually work very well. You have to kind of sit near them the whole time.
Yeah, and I guess with space heaters, there's always that danger that people don't use them enough, so they're not used to them, and then you get fires. Let's talk about the current situation. How much has it snowed?
Well, actually, the problem isn't really the snow. It has snowed in the mountainous areas of Taiwan, including in the tallest mountain in Taipei, the capital. It's about the snow The cold front left about 9 centimeters, which is about 3.5 inches of snow, on Yamingshan Mountain over the weekend. And generally in the mountainous areas, people are having a good time because some people even drive up there to see the snow and to have snow fights and take pictures because it's so rare for Taiwanese people to be able to experience a snow. The death toll hasn't really been in the mountains. It's been in the lower areas, the foothills or even the cities where people, especially elderly people, are not used to this sudden drop in temperature. And just to give you an idea how sudden it was, it went from about 16 degrees on Friday afternoon Celsius to 4 degrees only on Sunday morning. So that was a sudden drop. And, you know, as you know, a lot of elderly people, they already have some, you know, health problems anyway, like heart disease or cardiovascular illnesses. And some of them just simply couldn't cope. And, you know, I should point out a social change in Taiwan now, increasing number of elderly people are living by themselves. Mm. So, you know, they're not looked after by relatives.
Yeah, so that's a drop of 61 degrees Fahrenheit down to 40 degrees, just hovering around freezing. Why are more elderly people living on their own?
Well, Taiwanese families have changed in the past couple of decades. I mean, more and more young people have left small towns and rural areas and have moved to the cities to work. And even in the cities, a lot of people no longer live with their parents or their in-laws. They have their own apartments. And, you know, young people or young couples, they prefer to live on their own. So we're not seeing this kind of like traditional Taiwanese family where you have three generations under one roof. Now it's just a lot of elderly people are living by themselves. And so it's not something they can change right away because, again, this is not the kind of weather system we get usually. So it's not like people are going to install, you know, indoor heating in their homes, which could be quite expensive.
So when was the last time Taiwan saw the temperatures drop this much?
Well, Taipei is the city that the Central Weather Bureau uses to measure the weather system here. And the last time Taipei saw such cold weather was 44 years ago.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was in the 1970s. So it's been a long time. You know, and like you said, it was like a generation ago.
My colleague with the BBC, Cindy Su, in the Taiwanese capital, Taipei, you're going to have to imagine her speaking to me in a big, puffy down parka because she is. Cindy, thank you very much. Stay warm.
Thank you.
Nepal, on the other hand, is no stranger to snow because, you know, the Himalayas, among other things. So that's not why young men are fleeing Nepal. Since the early 2000s, they've been going to find work in the Persian Gulf. Nearly 500,000 Nepalis left home last year alone to work overseas. Many of them often leave behind young wives, and that is changing their lives, too. Laura Spiro sent us a story about one young woman in Kaskakot, Nepal.
Bishnu Parand is 21. As we talk in the garden near her house, her 1.5-year-old daughter is playing nearby. 3 years ago, Bishnu was in 11th grade when she texted a wrong number, and a boy answered. His name was Dirgaraj, and they started corresponding. She says she got more interested in love than school. One day, he asked to call her his girlfriend. She told him she had to think about it. But then she thought, once in your life, you have to fall for someone. So whatever it's about, I should do it. Who knows? Just like that, she was in love. Bishnu's father had died when she was 11, and her mother was abroad by the time she was 16. So when her aunt began arranging her marriage, she called the boy. And he just said, come. Every astrologer she'd ever visited had advised her, don't marry until you're 30. But she took a bus to meet him, and a few days later, they were married. After about a year, though, Dirgaraj became restless to earn a better income. And like hundreds of thousands of other young Nepali men, he made a decision. One day while I was out of the house, he began making arrangements to go work overseas. It's only 2 years, he said. In 2 years, no matter where we go, we'll be together. Dirgaraj left to work as a security guard in Qatar just 1 month before his daughter Ayusha was born. 7 months later, Bishnu was on a bus when she overheard something. A young man from their village had died in Qatar. It was a heart attack. He had a baby girl. It was Dear Garage. And just like that, at the age of 20, Bishnu became a widow.
There's so many challenges that widows have to face after their husband's death.
Lily Thapa is the founder of Women for Human Rights, an organization that's been advocating on behalf of single women in Nepal for 20 years. She says that traditionally, widows don't remarry or move out of their marital homes. Until recently, the law required that women get permission from male family members to obtain passports or inheritances or land.
Once the husband died, then she's nowhere.
10 years ago, Lily helped found the Red Color Movement, which aims to shift the tradition that widows don't wear red. To put this custom in context, it isn't easy to find traditional female clothing that isn't red. Women marry in red, celebrate in red, apply bright red cinder powder to their foreheads daily. To abstain from the color red, Lily tells me, is to abstain from beauty and celebration. Today is the one-year anniversary of Dear Garage's death. The house is filled with visitors and ritual offerings, but the detail that captures my attention is Bishnu's red sandals.
Okay, so we're gonna look at some photos. Wow, he's beautiful.
Bishnu is negotiating the boundary between customary ritual and modern womanhood. And there are many mourning traditions that she's chosen to observe. She doesn't wear bangles on her wrists or put bright red cinder powder in her hair. She's stayed here with her in-laws for a year to honor the loss of her beloved. But with today's anniversary behind her, she's preparing to leave. Nobody's going to say, hey, you need some money, she points out. Bishnu is really clear about one thing. Looking after herself doesn't mean abandoning her in-laws. But it doesn't help any of them for her to languish here, doing nothing with her life. And these days, people understand that. If my in-laws had said, you have to stay here, take care of us, there's nothing I could have done about it. But they tell me, do whatever makes you happy. Just bring Ayusha to see us. When I contacted Bishnu 8 months later, she was resettled in the village where she was born. She's planning for her future, just like she was 4 years ago, that day she texted a wrong number. But now she's not wearing bangles, and maybe she never will. For the world, I'm Laura Spiro in Kaskikot, Nepal.
Here's a weird one. Whales are washing up on the beaches of the North Sea, and as you might expect, scientists are really alarmed by this. They don't have a solid idea of why it's happening. Andrew Brownlow is with the Scottish Marine Animal Stranding Scheme. What beaches have you been to, and what do you see when you get there?
Well, we flew over to the island of Texel. This is a long, sandy beach, and it's like nothing I've ever seen, to be honest. We were walking along there, and there are these huge animals just entirely dwarfing the people who were around them. And the thing that was amazing was that the ones that we were dealing with were actually just juveniles and teenagers, sort of 11 meters long. But even that, they would have weighed sort of 25, 30 tons probably. And they took us hours and hours and hours to be able to even just begin to investigate what had been going on with them.
Incredible. And they were all dead.
By that time, they're sadly all dead. I mean, once they are left stranded by a receding tide, they simply crush themselves under their own body weight because they no longer have the buoyancy of the ocean to keep them afloat.
At the risk of hitting a gory note here, I've heard about horrific scenes where whales are stranded and die on the sand, the body starts to rot, and can actually explode if the gas buildup.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one that I post-mortemed on Texel, that one blew up. I mean, it's pretty nerve-wracking, to be honest. You can hear it fizzing. You can hear it degassing because the gases are building up and building up and building up. You make the incisions in the tissue and it sort of begins to expand under the pressure that's in there. And when I made the incision through the abdominal wall, there was this almighty bang. And I mean, the risk of sort of being a little bit too gory on this, most of the intestines and the abdominal contents basically left through the side of the whale. That's just what happens with these animals. They're so big that they don't cool down significantly after death. So decomposition and gas buildup continue and you end up with a pressure cooker in the abdominal cavity, which you've got to be really careful where you stand when you open that.
So why did this happen?
I wish I could give you a quick answer to that. And I suppose the quick answer is we don't know. The reason that Cetacean Strand is a mystery, it's one that we've been looking at for decades. We understand a lot of the reasons that cause cetaceans to strand in general. It can be exposure to sound, exposure to toxins in the marine environment. It can be because they're injured in some way, they've been hit by something. Sometimes it can just be because they're in the wrong place, their navigation hasn't worked and they've come into an area which has got a very high tidal range, or it can be something new. But from what we know about the structure of the undersea area in this southern North Sea, it's a really bad place for these animals to be.
Why is that?
And, well, fundamentally, it's too shallow, 50 metres deep, often shallower than that. This is a species that exists off the deep ocean trenches, dives to 1,500, 2,000 metres to be able to forage. They navigate, communicate using acoustic clicks. And we think in this very, very shallow environment that's got very acoustically absorbing material, like lots of sand, they can't navigate or communicate very well. So they're coming into these waters following prey, squid. They're ending up in places like the southern North Sea, which is functionally a whale trap. And once they've got in there, it's very difficult for them to extricate themselves and get back out again. I guess it's analogous to us trying to sort of find our way through a forest in thick fog. You can see the trees that are immediately close to you, but you don't get a feeling for the landscape. I suspect that played a role here.
You know, it's hard to know when you'll figure out kind of what this mystery is all about, but how worried are you just by the surge of deaths, just how many sperm whales dying at once?
It means to see these number of animals, these massive animals all lined up on a beach is astonishing. It really gets to you in a way that it is definitely worth investigating and looking to try and get to the bottom of, because only by doing that will we know what happens to all of our marine environment, the ecosystem as a whole. This is why we need to investigate this in the sort of detail that we do, because it could be a sort of a bad news story in the sense of it could be to do with what we as a civilization are doing to the marine environment, and not just these very kind of charismatic sperm whales.
Andrew Brownlow from the Scottish Marine Animal Stranding Scheme, thanks very much, and good luck figuring this out.
Thank you very much indeed.
A quick note before we take a short break. It's about the war in Syria and about one man who has chosen to stay in the war-torn city of Aleppo and why he stays. His name is Abu Omar, and he's 69 years old. Our colleagues at the BBC managed to get some video of him describing why he stays. You can hear Abu Omar playing an old record player and explaining that he loves old things that were built to last, like cars from the 1950s and 60s, he says. And that's the remarkable part. Abu Omar has a collection of 24 vintage cars. You can recognize a couple of American 1950s models in that video. There's a yellow Chevy pickup, an elegant white Buick sedan. Abu Omar says when the rest of his family fled Aleppo for safety, he decided to stay to look after his precious car collection. But here's the thing. Aleppo's a war zone, and his cars are parked out on the street. So when the bullets are flying, there's not much Abu Omar can do. He points to the bullet holes on one car and says his collection has taken a few hits. And when that happens, says Abu Omar, it's like one of his children is hurt. But he says he's determined to fix what he can and wait for the war to end. We've got video of Abu Omar and his car collection at PRI.org. This is The World. Marco Werman here with The World. The World Health Organization issued a warning today. It said the mosquito-borne Zika virus is likely to spread to all countries in the Americas except Canada and Chile. A lot of countries in between are already affected, and concern about the virus is mounting. That's because an increase in Zika cases in Brazil has coincided with a surge of babies born with abnormally small heads. Now health officials in some countries are urging women to avoid getting pregnant. One of those countries is El Salvador. Luis Fajardo is with our partners at BBC Mundo. So they're kind of proposing like a zero child policy. How does the government in El Salvador think it can enforce that? And until 2018?
Well, this is obviously going to be extremely difficult. In most Latin American countries, there are very high rates of unplanned pregnancies. Many women rights activists are suggesting that a woman who gets pregnant should have the right to have an abortion. And this is bringing another, even more complex issue, which is the issue of abortion. El Salvador has one of the most strict anti-abortion laws in the world. Abortion is prohibited in all cases, including cases where the health of the mother would be in risk. And the government is willing to enforce them. There were 129 women who were sentenced for abortion-related crimes between 2000 and 2011, and a few of them are actually facing murder charges.
Yeah, so considering this is, as you say, a public health emergency, is the government going to give consideration to lifting the abortion ban?
They have not given indication they're doing so. Even the fact that they were suggesting that women should exercise family planning to delay abortions until 2018, even that caused a lot of controversy. And El Salvador is not the only country facing these issues. For example, in Colombia, Colombia also suggested that women should delay pregnancies for 6 months. In the case of Colombia, abortions are allowed in cases where the mother's health is in danger. So women's rights activists are suggesting that this would be the moment to change the law, to presenting solutions for these women. But at this moment, the government is not suggesting that it is ready to do that.
I mean, the suggestion that women do not get pregnant until 2018 suggests perhaps a level of panic that maybe we hadn't suspected within the Zika crisis. Are you sensing that as well?
Definitely. The Zika crisis is involving thousands of people. It's also creating, obviously, besides the health issues, a very serious economic problem for many of these countries. Many of the countries that send tourists to these countries are suggesting to their own citizens that they should avoid going there. So it is creating a very, very serious situation, which I guess they think warrants these extreme suggestions by the government. But the likelihood that they would be able to create any concrete results from this, at this point, a lot of people are seeing it with a lot of skepticism.
Luis, to your memory, has any country in Latin America ever considered asking women not to get pregnant?
Not as far as I know. No, I don't think so. I don't think that any country has suggested that. Women's rights activists are saying that this is, in a sense, wishful thinking. Most pregnancies in many countries in Latin America, are a very high percentage of them are unplanned. So the government is suggesting something that is very, very unlikely they would even remotely be able to implement.
My colleague at BBC Mundo, Luis Fajardo, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Staying in Latin America for our final segment today, you're listening to the band Monsieur Periné from Bogotá, Colombia.
Te dije adiós, llegaste tarde para despedirnos. Y si el destino apresurado quiso herirnos, yo descubrí una solución.
Catalina Garcia is the band's lead singer and one of its three founders. She met the other two, Santiago Prieto and Nicolas Junca, at university in Bogotá. They were already musicians. Santiago and Nicolas had discovered French gypsy swing on the internet and were kind of obsessed. Catalina liked singing for fun and was good at it. Catalina, Santiago, and Nicolas became friends, went on vacation together. The guys played their guitars. Catalina sang along, and they'd veer between the Latin sounds they knew and loved and gypsy swing.
We went back in Bogotá, and we started, like, playing different kind of Latin American music, you know, like bossa nova or bolero or son cubano. And we always ended up mixing this kind of music with swing for bossa nova, swing for bolero, swing for, and that's how we start like doing this kind of mix. And then we start like mixing also those mixes with our Colombian roots.
As Catalina and I were talking, Santiago Prieto came in the room.
Hi. Hi, Santiago.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Tell me what this is.
He was carrying an antique, the most bizarre-looking violin I've ever seen.
And I found that they played this instrument in the first recording of tango music. And it's really nice. It sounds like an old violin.
For listeners, imagine a violin neck with the whole wooden body taken away and replaced with like an old gramophone. Can you just play a couple of notes? Or yeah, what does it sound like? You're playing something that sounds very Celtic.
Yeah, well, I play for two songs in our set now. And one is a song like which is like very inspired in klezmer music.
Klezmer is also part of the Monsieur Perrinet mix because it was part of Gypsy Swing, which catches on today in Colombia, says Catalina Garcia, because of a now late composer named Lucho Bermudez, who took Colombian rhythms like cumbia and made them swing, but in a chandelier setting.
So in Colombia, in the 40s, this kind of music was really popular. They used to dance in ballrooms this elegant cumbia with the big band sound.
And now the current version of that mix comes out of Bogota, courtesy of Monsieur Perrinet. They were awarded Best New Artist of the Latin Grammys last year, which for a gypsy swing cumbia dance act makes you feel like there's fatigue with more conventional Latin music.
We hope so.
Yeah. Well, we have seen that, like, the industry, they tend to homogenize all music and tend to make, like, famous the artists they want to make famous. It's like certain mafia, if it can be said. But we have seen and we have also, like, felt the market is changing. It's opening for new sounds.
I'm always open for new sounds, so here's some more from Colombia's own Monsieur Perrinet. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.